Hello, everyone. It's Scott Carley here from the College Exploration, and this is March the 1st. And this is the clean network call for that day. And, are there any announcements to make to everyone? Kent, there's got to be things going on. Well, I can mention that next week our presentation is from Paul Fleshman, who is going to talk about a book that he's written called Eyes Wide Open, Going Behind the Environmental Headlines. And so this is a book for young adults, and I hope you've had a chance. I think I put the slides up. I think we already have slides. There's certainly a – yep, the slides are already there. And there's a website that you can have a look at. So should be a different presentation, but certainly talking in some ways about the same kinds of audiences that Josh will be talking about today. So I hope you can join us next week on the 8th. So did that prompt any other announcements? We are a very quiet group today. Well, if not, we can get started, I hope. Are you there, Josh?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, good. There was that moment of panic where, am I off here by myself?
Right.
So I guess we'll start with our presentation today, and Josh Rosenau from the National Center for Science Education is going to present on the National Survey of Climate Change Features that the center did with Penn State University, and I guess it's Eric Plitzer is the person from there that was, in fact, the lead author on the article that came out in Science just a couple of weeks ago. And Josh is going to talk a bit about the background of this report and more details. In some ways, I think more details that are actually in the Science article, too. So I hope everyone's been able to download the slides and can follow on. And let's go for it, Josh. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you all for having me here. And I tried to keep the slides short. I put in some more things in the slides than I might necessarily talk about, but so I'll leave plenty of time for questions and we can dig into this. The goal here was really to create a survey that would be useful to communities like this, as well as serve our own nefarious purposes at NCSE. For those of you who don't know about us, we really focus on stopping bad things from happening and keeping them from being able to happen in classrooms. And so when over a few years ago, we started noticing a lot more conflict over climate change, similar to what we were used to dealing with on the evolution front. And so as we got involved in that, we realized that not only was it not clear to us what was actually happening in classrooms, but that it wasn't necessarily clear to anyone what teachers were actually doing day to day as they were thinking about climate change. Were they teaching it? Were they teaching it well? Were messages of denial creeping into the classrooms? What was the real scope of the problem that we were confronting, and what were the opportunities there? So building on a survey that Eric Plutzer and his colleague Michael Berkman had done in 2007 of biology teachers and how they covered evolution, we worked with Eric Plutzer at Penn State to develop a survey, which the results just came out in Science. I'm looking at the second slide here. I hope you'll all check out the paper. There's a lot of great material there. And there's more from the survey that's going to be coming out in the near future. Any day now, we're expecting a paper to come out in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists that talks about some results that are not in the Science paper. And we're working on other work to analyze these data in other ways and try to find out more about what drives different teaching approaches and different ways that people think about climate change education. So the Science paper has gotten a lot of great coverage. Some of you may have seen that we even showed up in The Onion, which is not where my work usually gets covered, but always exciting to see that. And it was a good hall of teachers. We got about 1,500 responses from all 50 states. We sent out a survey in the mail, and we also gave teachers an opportunity to respond online. And so we sent it out to a random sample of about 5,000 teachers. And when you exclude people who, you know, mail that bounced back and other things, that's about a 37% response rate, which is pretty good for this sort of work. And because we know that climate change is a cross-disciplinary subject, and we weren't sure exactly where it was being taught, we broke down the teachers. We stratified the sample to include a large chunk of middle school teachers, as well as oversampling earth science teachers, who are a relatively small portion of the overall distribution of teachers in the U.S. But we figured if anyone was teaching climate change, it would be them, so we wanted to be sure that we had a good sample of those, as well as biology, chemistry, and physics teachers. Our initial prediction was that we wouldn't get a lot of chemistry and physics teachers teaching climate change, but we wanted to put that to the test. So what we found, the first question that we asked teachers was how long they spent on climate change and a range of other subjects. We tried not to tip our hand about what our preferences might be as far as the teachers' responses. So we asked them about climate change, but also a range of other subjects that we expected would show up in their curriculum. And of the teachers, about three-quarters of the teachers said that they spent at least an hour talking about climate change over the course of a year, which is not a ton, and the median amount was the 1 or 2 hours category. But as you can see, I'm on the fifth slide here, there is a long tail of teachers who spend quite a bit of time. Some of them even chose the more than 20 hours option, which was exciting to see. And of the teachers who did spend at least an hour on climate change, the average amount of hours was just under five. It was about 4.5. And that we were surprised to find that even among chemistry and physics teachers, about half of them said that they spent at least an hour talking about climate change, which was exciting because even though we would certainly advocate that, and I think a lot of you have probably been beating that drum also, we weren't really expecting that it would show up in that frequency, certainly in the physical sciences. And it's not surprisingly, the earth science teachers, it was something like 98% of them said that they spent at least an hour teaching climate change. Biology teachers and middle school teachers also spend quite a bit of time on climate change, which is really exciting because almost every student takes middle school science, almost every student takes biology. So if it's showing up in those classrooms, that's an important threshold that we're crossing. The fight is not to get it into the classroom at all. It's to make sure that the science is being taught accurately. It's to raise those numbers from 1 or 2 hours to an amount of time that I think would be, I think we could all agree would be more appropriate than that pretty minimal coverage. But at least just showing up, the message is getting out there that this is a subject that teachers ought to be covering in a science classroom. We asked them, when they teach about climate change, do they emphasize the scientific consensus? And around 80% of the teachers said that they did when they were teaching about climate change. And that was really encouraging. Obviously, it would be nice to get that number higher, but relative to what Berkman and Plusser had found when they asked about evolution, where about a quarter of the teachers said that they emphasized the scientific consensus and the position of the National Academy of Sciences, this is much better. The worrisome thing is that when we asked a similar question about whether they emphasize that many scientists believe recent changes or recent increases in temperature are likely due to natural causes, that 43% either agreed or strongly agreed with that statement, which, as you know, is not true. It's not true that many scientists think that natural causes are driving climate change. Indeed, there's a growing view that natural forcings probably had a negative effect on climate change over the last century or so. And because those were separate questions, we could cross-tabulate them and find that about a little over half of the teachers only emphasized the scientific consensus. about a third of them do both. They emphasize the scientific consensus, but they also emphasize natural causes. And I can't imagine what students come away with when they're taught that way. And I can't imagine any other subject that teachers would teach that way. You can't imagine a teacher going in and saying, well, some people say that gravity exists because objects with mass tend to attract each other, but other scientists disagree. Make up your own minds. And about 10% of the teachers said that they only emphasized the message of natural causes, that they didn't talk about the consensus, and 5% of the teachers didn't talk about either. So, that's sort of the bad news. The climate change is in the classrooms, but what's being taught may not be scientifically accurate, or it may be undercut by these mixed messages and overt denial. And the reasons for that are not totally clear. The rate of pressure that the teachers reported, we asked them whether they had been contacted by other teachers, by parents, by students, by administrators, by other community members, and either urged not to teach climate change. And it's on the order of 5% of the teachers who reported that sort of pressure or pressure to teach climate change, and about the same numbers. And here, I was glad to see that most of that pressure was coming from other teachers. So teachers are talking to each other and encouraging them to teach climate change. I think that there are really important opportunities there to network through teachers to make sure that they're getting the resources that they need. Those numbers are substantially less than the rate at which teachers reported pressure either to teach or not to teach evolution, either from other teachers or from the community or administrators or parents. Even though there's not that overt pressure, we can see pretty clear signs that they are experiencing some sort of pressure. When we asked them what tactics they used to respond to the idea that there is a controversy, if any, and this is a question that we modified from a survey that Sarah Wise had done in Colorado teachers, and her survey, full credit, gave us a lot of inspiration for how we thought about this survey. Around 40% of the teachers said that they used tactics that we would find problematic. So this is not including things like emphasizing what the standards say, emphasizing that there is a scientific consensus and that that's what they're teaching, other things that are not that we wouldn't find problematic as a way of addressing a concern that a student might have. But this is letting the students discuss the issue without the teacher taking any position on the outcome, which again is not something that you can imagine a teacher doing for the periodic table of elements or the cell theory. Giving equal time to arguments for and against the reality of climate change or its human causes, offering to meet students after class, sending a letter home to parents warning them that a climate change lesson is coming out, allowing students to opt out, or simply avoiding the subject entirely. The fact that so many teachers, even if they're not being told by someone you shouldn't teach climate change, the fact that so many of them are still feeling like they have to couch it in these ways suggests that they are feeling pressure of some sort, that they recognize that this is a controversial issue and they feel like they need to do something to diffuse that. Part of what's driving that may be a misperception about the state of the science itself. We asked them to give their estimate of how many scientists agree that climate change is real and caused by humans. And 1 in 5 of the teachers said that they didn't know. 40% of them said that they correctly estimated that it was over 80%, 80 to 100%. But that leaves 40% who chose an estimate that was too low, when the real value is 97%. That's a really big gap between their perception of the science and the reality of the science. And we know from surveys of the public and from other work that the perception of the consensus is a powerful gateway to personally accepting the reality of climate change and desire to do something about it. And it also shapes teachers' pedagogy. So when we compare the perceived the estimates of the perceived consensus to the likelihood that a teacher will present natural causes in classrooms or will not, will refuse to present natural causes, or to emphasize that many scientists think natural causes are driving climate change, teachers who estimated that it was in that 80 to 100% range, about 80% of them said that they did not talk about natural causes. Those with lower estimates or who said that they didn't know were more likely to teach that, to emphasize natural causes in their classes. So there's pretty strong evidence that perceived that getting the idea of the strength of the scientific consensus across can be a powerful way to move people towards better pedagogies. Personal politics, as we know, can be a big shaper of views on climate change, and that also shapes their pedagogical choices. Democrats are far less likely to emphasize natural causes than Republicans. Democrats are far more likely to refuse to give equal time to denial than Republicans are, and they're more likely to discourage debate in their classroom as a pedagogical tool or as a way to defuse the controversy. And following what lots of work that people have done in public opinion, personal politics shape people's perception of the consensus. So we used a standard question where we asked people whether the role of government is to either not to protect people from themselves, or if the role of government is to look out for the common good and that we're all in this together, a sort of communitarian versus individualist dimension that a lot of people, including Dan Kahan and others, have found to be really predictive of people's views of climate change. And as we see here on the slide 15, it's strongly predictive of someone's perception of the consensus. But even among the people who are most ideologically inclined to accept the reality of climate change, there is still that consensus gap, which we can think of as an information deficit, that even the most liberal teachers, the ones who we would think of as most inclined to accept the reality of climate change and to think that there would be a consensus, even they tend to underestimate the consensus, while the most conservative teachers underestimate the consensus far more. This is also true. There's interesting interactions there with the amount of training the teachers had. So we asked whether they had taken college courses, how many college courses, how many sections of a course that they had taken in college, as well as sections or courses of continuing education classes. And the teachers who were in the highest quintile for trainings were had a smaller gap between their perception and the reality than the ones with the least training, although again there is still a strong interaction with politics. And community context matters a lot, and this is something that we're going to be digging into more because I think it's really interesting that even if you are relatively conservative personally, if you live in a county that was in the top quintile for Democratic vote share in the last couple of elections, that your perception of the scientific consensus is far greater than if you live in the most Republican quintile of counties. And many school districts are at the county level, so the fact that county level effect, I think, is probably really important. It corresponds to the pressure that teachers are facing when they're in line at the grocery store, when they're talking to parents, when they're talking to administrators, when they're looking at how school boards are being elected. You know, all of those interactions, both political and social, a lot of them are in that county level. And so the fact that they're picking up on that and that that's shaping their perception of the consensus, and I don't have this here, but the bullet in the Atomic Scientists paper talks about how that also does play out as a predictor of pedagogical practices of various sorts. So this is something that, you know, getting people to be more vocal about the importance of climate education, this gives reason to think that it could actually make teachers more comfortable teaching the science forthrightly, make them understand that they have that community support, may
may increase their willingness to teach climate change accurately and increase their assessment of the consensus. As I said, we asked about their training. Fewer than half of the teachers in general had taken a college course on climate change. And even if they had taken a college course, half of teachers would have graduated from college before the IPCC statements were saying that there was a strong consensus that humans were definitely causing climate change. So even that formal training in college is not necessarily going to be the state of the art as it is today. This is a science that's moving forward rapidly, and so continuing education is really important for teachers to keep them caught up. But even so, a lot of teachers had not taken either a continuing education course or college courses about climate change. So there's a lot of room there for improvement, and I know a lot of the folks on this call are doing that work, and we'd love to talk to you about the survey findings and ways that the survey can be useful to help guide that really important work that's going on. Encouragingly, a lot of the teachers, even in chemistry and physics, which again are subjects where you might not expect to find as much interest in climate change, a lot of the teachers would be interested in taking a course on climate change or a course that included a section about climate change. About 60% of the teachers would support that. And there was even a majority of the teachers who said that they emphasized natural causes, said that they would be interested in taking such a course. One caveat there is that it's certainly the case that the teachers who are most interested in taking additional courses are the ones who are already spending the most time on climate change. That's the most true in earth science, where the average number of hours that the teachers who were interested in further coursework was about twice as many hours as the teachers who were not so interested in further training. So that's something where we need to think about ways to reach those teachers who don't think that they need that extra training, but probably need it the most. And that training is going to be really important because there are indications that there are a lot of misconceptions beyond the big divide of teaching natural causes versus human causation. When we ask them what topics they would want to include in a 2 or 3 day unit on greenhouse gases and recent global warming, we included things like the different effects of long wave and short wave radiation, sort of the mechanism underlying the greenhouse effect. We asked them about carbon emissions from industry. We asked them about deforestation and other related issues that certainly were topical. But we also asked them about things like the impact of launching rockets into space, depletion of ozone holes, pesticides to destroy insect pests, and use of aerosol spray cans. And about 3/4 of the teachers said that they would be interested, that they thought that those would be either a high priority or a medium priority for a 2 or 3 day unit on greenhouse gases and recent global warming. So that suggests that they're seeing this as a sort of grab bag of environmental issues and not necessarily honing in on the really central aspects of climate change specifically. So there's certainly work to be done there. But again, the fact that they are thinking of this as something that they do teach and that they want to be teaching gives an opening there to help guide them away from some of the topics that are less relevant and towards the current state of the science. We're going to have more news about all of this on our website and on our social media. I hope you'll get in touch with us, and I've tried to leave a bunch of time for questions, so I hope that you have them. Thank you all.
Wonderful. Thank you, Josh. So any questions for Josh?
Josh, this is Frank Nipolda. I'm sorry I got on late, but you may have already gone over it, but the full report that Minda mentioned to me, is that available yet? Have you already gone into that?
We're working on a more detailed report that it's in its final copy editing stages right now, so we should have that up on the website soon.
possibly this week, and if not, hopefully next week. It's just wrapping up right now, and I don't know if Minda shared a draft of that with you, but it's...
Oh, no, she just mentioned
okay. it. Yeah. Well, yeah, there's more detail, and I did mention early on that there's a paper coming out in Bulletin of Atomic Scientists any day now, and other research that we're planning to publish out of this over in the coming months.
But the detailed report, with really getting into the data richness of what the survey has, is coming out within a couple weeks, something in that range.
Yeah. Possibly this week,
okay.
But next week, if not.
Spectacular. I think the community will find.
Yeah, have detailed data tables and lots of other information. There will be Eric. If he hasn't already posted, I think he's planning. He might be planning to post it in parallel with that report. A Dataverse that will have a replication data set for that full report, as well as I believe copies of the survey instruments and everything else that people can look at and can do their own analyses with as well.
And just one quick follow-up to that. With a sample size as large as what you had, did you collect geographic data so you could actually see any sub-national information in that detailed report? Similar to like some of the stuff that Six Americas has been able to do? Because when you have 1,000 samples, you actually have some, now you have 1,500, you have some, there's still some statistical significance of subnational information, but this depends on what other data you collected to see if you can actually do that.
We, for the data set that we have, I think it's matched up with the zip code of the teacher's school. I think
right.
In the replication data set, it wouldn't have that level of detail because you really could identify individual teachers from that if you tried hard enough. So as a matter of privacy, I think that the public data set is going to be more limited. So I did show one thing that I'd done looking at counties. We've done a little bit looking at census regions. If you try to get down to the state level, you know, we did have at least one person from every state, but there are states where, you know, that just have really small populations, and a representative sample would be one or two people. So at the state level is harder to do, but certainly you can look at trends among states based on economy or I've done, in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists paper, we talk about some correlations with the state and county estimates that the Six Americas group have published.
Right.
But certainly awesome. Census region, I think we have their reasonable sample sizes in all of those, for instance.
Right. But do you have data plots for those? No, I'll be quiet. Do you have data plots for those?
Not in this round, but I think that's something that we were going to come back to, because we wanted to, for this top line report, we wanted to be able to have the replication data set available, and figuring out how to handle the geographic information is tricky.
Gotcha.
In terms of privacy and making it replicable. So I don't think we don't have any maps in this report, but we're talking about doing more with geography down the road.
Awesome.
So this is Linda. Hey, Frank. Are you wondering that because you're thinking a little bit that folks in different parts of the country might be able to use this information to support reasons for getting funding or grants or that sort of thing? Or is it more just curiosity how different states fall apart on this?
Well, so the where I'm coming from is that you know, one of the things that our community has been doing is evolving away from national, right? And one of the geniuses of the Next Generation Science Standards implementation logic is that it's states, five states, four states, right? So there is no national education initiative here. It's really below national. And, you know, different states and different districts and states are making progress. And your work is, as you said in the paper, is a much more replicable and a better practice survey than some of the previous ones that are in the subject area. So thereby you have a baseline. And if you connect those two things, you have a baseline and you have, how does that baseline move to subnational, similar to what Six Americas has been doing with, Six Americas for Massachusetts, Six Americas for Virginia, as opposed to Six Americas for the America. And I'm just wondering if you guys follow that same path, because what happens in Western Maryland is really going to be different than what happens in Central Maryland, or what happens in Maryland is going to be different than what happens in Virginia.
To get to the state level, we would need a lot more data than 1,500 samples doesn't really get you that.
Yep.
The Six Americas group has been doing their polls for a decade now, so they've got probably 60,000 samples that went into the state and county predictions that they did. So we certainly would hope to be able to get to that point where we have a database of that many responses. This is certainly something that we are hoping to come back to and do follow-up surveys down the road, both to replicate this one exactly and to ask different questions. And so hopefully in the end we will have something that we can project out that finally. But even so, looking at correlations with a trend like vote share and other things should let us make reasonable predictions about a region, even if we don't have a sample from that state or from that part of the state. Certainly in terms of like the natural causes question, in the state, the region that has the least likely to emphasize natural causes was, not surprisingly, New England. The region that's most likely is the West, South, Central. That's like Mississippi around there, with East, South, Central coming in close behind. So there are certainly predictable regional differences, but it's not as big a difference as you might think. It's a difference of around 65% to around 43%. So it's not, these sorts of things are happening every place, and I think that's an important message from all of this.
I think that's just the last point on this, that point you just made about Southeast Central, and if that's a scale that I could work with, I would find interested in if you had data plots or analysis of that, that even if it's multi-state, it's still better than national.
Yeah.
So
I think it should be, I don't remember what the sample sizes are for that, but that should be reasonable enough to have sensible error bars.
Exactly. Thank you.
Josh, this is Roberta in Kentucky. And I have a quick question before I have to drop off this call. But on your next to the last slide about misconceptions, you had four topics here that you suggest as possibly teaching in your wording here. Were those all grouped together in one question the way you've done it here? And then you've just, averaged their responses? Or did you ask specific individual questions for each topic?
The question was phrased, imagine that you were asked to teach a 2 or 3 day unit on greenhouse gases and recent global warming. What priority would you give to including each of the following possible topics? And then they were offered high priority, medium priority, it's not necessary, this should not be covered, or I don't have an opinion. And the topics were destruction of forests, carbon dioxide trapping heat in the atmosphere, use of aerosol spray cans, people heating and cooling their homes, depletion of ozone in the upper atmosphere, use of coal and oil by utilities, use of chemicals to destroy insect pests. So they were mixed in with other topics.
Good. Yeah, that was my concern. I thought if you only presented them with bogus ones, then they probably would have thought they were important enough to rank as somewhat important. But that makes a lot more sense. Thank you.
Yeah, no, we tried to do that in a few places to make sure that we were, that there was something to make sure that people weren't just sort of filling out the first bubble or other things like that.
Right. Thanks.
So Josh, this is Scott. Just to clarify that, so our expectations is, and particularly on that particular slide, is that we expect that all to be zero for all categories. and yet we're running at 60 to 80%, of including at least one of those topics being relevant.
And for the most part, that's in the ozone or the aerosol spray cans.
Yeah.
Which I think is just, you know, it's a common confusion between, like, the ozone hole, green global warming, it's all the same sort of thing.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Josh, well, this is Joe Levine. First, I want to say that I think the work is incredible. It's really important. I wanted to note that you're finding that teachers' understanding of the scientific consensus was a key predictor of the way they taught it. And it's nice for me to hear that, because in a couple of weeks I'm going to be giving several lectures on this at NSTA. And so I will always stick in that 97% of scientists agree slide. And I think that's a good point to make. The question I had was that the project that I've been working on, first with NCSE and then UCMP together, and now mostly with UCMP, on global change, which, of course, was an NCSE suggestion for broadening out from, quote-unquote, just climate change. My experience in lecturing in some of those states where you would find less compliance with quality teaching is that when I talk about global change and include climate change, it somehow seems to take the knife edge off of the politics. Do you have any comments on that from either the survey itself or experience that you've had?
I don't know that I have any deep thoughts on that. I think Minda's on, and she may have something to say. But the one thing it's certainly the case that if you look at the state science standards, until pretty recently, certainly NGSS has changed this a lot. But if you looked at science standards 10 years ago, the discussion of climate change was often couched in those terms, as, you know, discuss ways that humans are affecting the environment, such as climate change, the ozone hole, acid rain, mass extinctions, and so forth. So that's certainly, I wouldn't be surprised if that's a framing that teachers are used to thinking about.
Uh-huh. Very interesting perspective.
Yeah.
So teachers who were brought up in that perspective might feel that having special focus on climate change is political rather than scientific. Is that what you're thinking, or is it just habit?
I'm thinking more in just in terms of habit and training and background, that, you know, I think all of this is a little bit in flux. The idea of climate change being part of the curriculum is relatively new in a lot of states. The science itself is changing relatively quickly compared to, you know, the basic message that I would have been taught in an evolution section in high school in the 90s is not so different in broad strokes than what you would teach now. What you would teach in a climate change section of a high school class today is really different from what you would teach in the 90s. So if I was a teacher and I was drawing on what I learned in high school and college, you know, there's just there's a lag there that is tricky to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
This is Don. I've got a question on that point. I'm wondering if you've thought of if there are analogs in other subjects to a scientific area that's risen substantially in recognized importance in the last 30 years or however many years you want to look at it. Nothing comes to mind for me, and I'm wondering if other people have things that come to mind. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I know that people often use nanotechnology as a, you know, people who are interested in science and technology studies in general often use that as a test bed, because it's something that's relatively new and is not profoundly polarized the way that something like evolution or climate change can be. So they'll use that to sort of see, you know, what can you do to have people think different ways or to engage with this emerging topic. There certainly seems to be a lot of discussion around genetic engineering as well. That would seem like another possible analog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, neither of which I think are taught at the same, even small level of climate changes. Yeah. And since I've got the floor, I want to go back to the question on geographic data, it sounds like you don't have this in the current data set, but looking forward, it would be, I think, very helpful to get to be able to come up with state level comparisons. And the greenhouse effect has been on the New York State. In the New York State Region's Earth Science curriculum since 1971. It's only, 1% of the curriculum or something like that, but it has been there. And my hunch would be that New York teachers think that means that they're doing a better job than other states, but my gut says it's probably not the case, and it'd be really interesting, really helpful to have data to figure that out. So that's more of a comment than a question, but...
Yeah, the geography is certainly going to be interesting. Just for context, we've got about 95 teachers from New York in the sample, 111 from California, 7 from New Hampshire. So some of those comparisons are going to be tricky to make.
Yeah.
100 is not really much to draw on.
Mm-hmm.
Just to build on that point, one of the things that we did on some of the early large Six Americas research was we actually ran the numbers, and for certain areas where you had certain densities, it's just statistics, right? You may not be able to do it for all states, but it might be interesting to see if there are any, just because of the way it worked out, a few comparisons. Just to set up the space for if you had California and New York, and that's the only two states in the entire data set that you actually could do this, it might be interesting just to be able to make a special data plot and a special visualization for where you do have, and with the error bars, obviously. But I think that would be very instructive.
Please show that this diversity in the country in terms of teaching.
But also, Scott, but building on exactly what Don said, is that there's also a perception that people are doing better than they think they are, than they actually are.
Yes, yeah. Good.
Josh?
Oh, go ahead, please.
Thanks so much for this work. This is Jane Heinz-Fry calling in, and forgive me if you hit this on slide 9. Can you tell me why it appears that the number of people teaching hours about climate change and earth science is very small? Was your sample size of earth science teachers very small? Was that why that section appears so limited? And if so, do you have any idea of why that the respondents from earth science is so low?
So the number of earth science teachers in the pool of American science teachers is relatively small. And so we oversampled them relative to their true rate of occurrence because we wanted to hear from them.
Yes.
But because we figured if anyone was teaching it was going to be there. So we oversampled from that group. But in the overall, a lot of states, it's not a required course. There's not an expectation. A lot of colleges don't give admissions credit for earth science as a lab course. So there's sort of some institutional barriers to offering it at all. So a lot of schools don't necessarily have an earth science teacher at all. And so that's why the plot that looks like it's got a bunch of radishes or something growing out of it?
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah.
That's
so
a great plot.
The black lines are scaled to the true population, to the true proportion in the population, and the green bars are relative to our samples. So as you can see, we pretty substantially oversampled relative to the true fraction of the population so that we would have a reasonable sample size of their science teachers here.
I see. Can I just say that I've been looking at strand maps of the new Massachusetts Science, Technology, Engineering standards, and they mm-hmm. are somewhat similar to the NGSS, but they've been tweaked a bit. And on the web, there is a strand map of just weather and climate, and it's clear that most of those standards are in earth science. There's a couple thrown in for physics, physical science. There are a few that are thrown in for life science. But it's concerning that so much of climate change is about earth science, and that that number of teachers and the number of students taking that those courses, especially at the high school level, is low. So let's keep that little piece of the formal education structure in mind. And thanks for your comments on that.
And Jane, this is
yes.
Joe Levine. If I could make a comment.
Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Good to hear you.
I've discussed exactly that point extensively with Michael Wysession, who was mm-hmm. one of the people working on the NGSS. He was in the
yes.
sort of core group. And he emphasized a couple things. First of all, that a lot of these standards originally were cross-correlated very strongly among the disciplines, and that at the 11th hour, Achieve decided to strip all those cross-correlations out. And the scientists and educators who were on the panel were mixed, upset, and furious. The
right.
other thing is that Michael emphasized, and I think all of us need to keep this in mind, that, you know, they say NGSS is not meant to be curriculum. One of the corollaries of that is that just because this is a topic that is labeled as earth science does not mean that it needs to be taught in an earth science class. And that contrary, you know, because if you actually look at what the NGSS did, it took not only climate, but it took virtually all physical aspects of the environment out of ecology, leaving only the so-called biotic factors in the life sciences section. And you can't teach ecology that way. You can't teach ecology without talking about the physical environment. So I think we need to figure out ways to make that obvious to the educators that we work with, that this may be called or labeled earth science. That doesn't mean either that it has to be only in an earth science course or that you can't teach it in life science.
And we're going to have to make that point over and over and over again, because that's not what it looks like. If you're looking for clarity and guidance, it just doesn't look that way when you're looking at those kind of visualizations. So
absolutely.
thanks for that explanation, but it does mean we're all going to have to say that over and over and over again.
Absolutely. Well, when I first talked to Michael about it, he was livid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm sure. I'm
because
sure.
they worked hard on making all those cross correlations.
So, Joel, maybe there's another principle in it. Go ahead, Jane. I'm sorry.
No, I'm finished. Someone
actually.
Else was coming in.
Oh,
this is Kristen. I wanted to pop in briefly and say this is another reason, though, why I know we're all excited about getting geographical data, but in places where Earth, I think it would be really interesting to see where, you know, the type of teachers that responded to this survey and where they were saying they taught climate change was, because I think it would be really different depending on even if, you know, of course my place is Minnesota, but in Minnesota it's a district level thing, and some districts are teaching earth science, and some, most of them, they'll have eliminated it. So the majority of teachers that I work with aren't teaching this in earth science classrooms. It's more in biology or even in social studies and other places. So it would be interesting to see that piece. And then I wanted to say the one other piece, of course, which I think was alluded to, but as a baseline, this would be just really interesting to follow up on in the states that now have adopted NDSS, if, to see if there's a change, if this is, you know, implemented again in X number of years after they've had a state, maybe not West Virginia, of course, right now, but a state which is implementing NDSS, if climate change is being taught the right way or even being taught more there. That's it. That's all I have to say. Go ahead, Frank.
But building on that, I think one of the actually, I make this point even better now. Thank you, Kristen. Is that the topic of climate change cannot only be taught by earth science teachers, and it can't only be taught by science teachers. It's too big, and there's a lot of concepts that have to be taught across the curriculum in order to do it right. And so when I'm looking at the radish plot, it's an interesting plot, but the teacher's conception of what they mean by teaching hours spent teaching climate change, because a lot of stuff that's important to climate change is actually something you wouldn't necessarily call climate change. Is El Nino climate change? Is seasons climate change? Is habitable zones climate change? I mean, if you look at the climate literacy framework, it's much bigger than just climate change. And I think that it's fair to say that, you know, in our analysis, at least 30% of the NGSS relates to climate change. That's a huge statement. But I don't think teachers necessarily would – I don't think there's a mismatch between what I think is the climate change part and what is the part that relates to climate change. And how they answer that question, I think, could be all over the map. But I would encourage you guys, as you expand this, to think about more than just science teachers, to build on what Kristen just said.
Sure.
Josh, this is Scott Carley here. One of the things I'm curious about, and it's kind of, I'm not sure if you had a chance to sort of step back a little bit from this. You kind of alluded to it, and it's actually continuing education. Certainly suggested that has an enormous role to play in this. Do you have some ideas of what that should look like? And all the stuff we've been talking about in terms of geographic distribution, and also the kind of spread, you know, the diversity of teachers and subjects that they teach, suggests that there's a kind of broad way of looking at continuing education that would have to, you know, encompass all of that. Do you have some ideas of what's not there, given that, you know, climate change and is for many of these teachers a relatively new thing in terms of their own training? What kinds of things should we be putting into our continuing education? I guess is really the bottom line.
Well, I think from the survey, I guess the big things would be just making sure that the size of the consensus is coming across to teachers, and knowing about some of these misconceptions that are out there. You know, it's easy for those of us who work closely on these issues, or for scientists who are putting together a program and who know the science really well, to not realize some of the, and we all know this as educators, that it's easy to lose track of the misconceptions that you had before you learned a subject. And so finding ways to recognize that and to overcome some of those misconceptions that we know are out there and that seem to be affecting quite a few of the teachers, that's certainly what were the priority that I would say. And I think that we talked about that in the science paper also.
Okay, you're going to get there, a little bit more prescription.
And also, good, you know, making sure the teachers understand the cultural context of, you know, why students might be coming in with objections to learning about climate change at all.
Mm-hmm. Good. Any other questions and comments?
No, I think we're running out of time. But something I think is worth talking about in the future is kind of how we can use this information to move forward and ensure that teachers are getting what they need to teach the science accurately.
Yeah, that was kind of the point of the question around continuing education. How do we really use the survey now to develop programs? Yes, exactly. and we will come back to that. This is really important.
And that's something that, you know, we like I said at the beginning, we really did put this together with an eye towards it being of service to communities like this one, mm-hmm. and to having not just having the product be in scientific journals, but also, you know, what are the practical ways that folks in the field can use this. So do definitely reach out to us, and if there are questions that you want to ask with it, or if there's a project that we can work on together to try to use this data to make people's lives better, that's really the goal.
Mm-hmm. Great.
From my perspective, I would say you absolutely met that goal. So thank you for that work.
Yeah.
That was Frank. That was to the whole team.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Any other final comments from anyone?
Thanks. Good stuff.
Yes, thanks. Thanks, Josh. And thanks to everyone for contributing to this really important conversation. So I'll just end by reminding you that we have a presentation next week, and Paul Fleshman will be talking about his book on called Eyes Wide Open, and how, as he says, it's explaining the environment to young adults. It should be very interesting and a little bit different talk. So please join us next week on the 8th. Great. Thanks again, Josh. Appreciate it. And Minda and Mark, who's probably not on the call, and the others who are involved in this very important work. Thanks to all of you.
Thanks
you.
For having
Thanks,
me.
Josh.
It was great being here.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye, all.